Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. JFK read James Bond in the White House. Lincoln read Shakespeare. Ronald Reagan liked sci-fi. George W. Bush famously noted he was reading Camus' The Stranger. Barack Obama's first work of fiction read in the White House, we're told, is Joseph O'Neill's Neverland. The president has mentioned it several times now, pronounced it excellent. White House watchers have pronounced it a natural for this president in these times. A beautifully written, grand and gritty portrait of a super multicultural New York and a portrait of this century's quest for American identity. It's been out for a year. You may have read it. We thought we'd put together a kind of super book club on the president's pick. This hour, On Point Netherland author Joseph O'Neill and our friend James McBride, best-selling author of The Color of Water, on this work, this depiction of an evolving America, Netherland. You can join the conversation. Have you read Netherland? Does it make sense as Obama's first extracurricular read in the White House? What's your question for Joseph O'Neill, for James McBride, on America's melting pot today? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is Joseph O'Neill, author of the best-selling book Netherland, which just won the Penn Faulkner Award. In three recent interviews, President Obama has mentioned that he's reading it. The president's called it fascinating, wonderful, excellent. But don't take his word for it. The New Yorker's James Wood calls it one of the most remarkable post-colonial books I've ever read. Michiko Kakutani of the New York Times calls it stunning and says it's a resonant meditation on the American dream. Compared it to The Great Gatsby. Joseph O'Neill grew up in Mozambique, South Africa, Iran, Turkey, and Holland. His background is part Irish, part Turkish, a heritage he writes about in his 2002 family memoir, Blood Dark Track. Joseph O'Neill, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure, Tom.
And joining us from New York is James McBride, best-selling author, memoirist, and musician. He's author of The Color of Water, a black man's tribute to his white mother, a memoir that's become a kind of classic. His latest novel is Song Yet Sung, which he talked about with us last year on Point. He worked with Spike Lee to develop his World War II novel Miracle at St. Anna into a movie of the same name last year. The two are continuing to collaborate. James McBride, thank you so much for being here today. Welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. Delighted to be back.
It's really good of both of you. This is a kind of mashup book club on the cuff here. A week or two ago, we had Elmore Leonard and former U.S. Poet Laureate Robert Pinsky on together. We thought that was a lot of fun. We're delighted to do a mashup here again. Joseph O'Neill, first to you. Here's the President of the United States saying more than once, what would seem to be quite deliberately, that he's reading your book and he really likes it. We know that's meant something in sales. I mean, we're reading that here. The paperback was rushed out as soon as the President made the comment. Of course, you've had plenty of plaudits already in advance of that in the Penn Faulkner Award. But how's it feel to have President of the United States talking about your book, his first read apart from, briefing papers?
Well, I mean, my first reaction, obviously, is one of disorientation. I mean, suddenly the distance between me and the president has collapsed, and I did have the opportunity to see a clip on the internet of him uttering my name and uttering the name of this book, and yeah, so that was quite a thrill.
James McBride, what do you make of it as the president's first pick? Here's a president who obviously could read anything in the world, and he's picked this book up. Some political, pundits have said nothing like this is done accidentally. They're reading a political message into this. I don't know. Personally, politically, what do you make of it?
I don't know about that. I think it's a very good book. I mean, it's a literary work. It's the kind of book that you just like to read at night when you go to bed. I mean, it's a good book. I don't sense that the president decided to pick this book because it was politically expedient. It just happens to be a book about a really interesting guy in a really interesting town. And Joseph is very good at capturing a certain element of New York City that so many people see from either behind the wheel of a locked car or just in passing on the subway. And I think that's part of the magic of the book. I mean, it's extremely well written, and it's very hard to write literary, kind of literary fiction that is attracted to the general public, which Joseph does very well. And so I don't think this is, I don't think the president has any other, I don't think he means anything else other than this is a really good book. I can see why he's attracted to the book, because of the central character, who is the kind of person who, you know, he's the kind of person who is kind of pushed around a little bit by society and by his ex, his wife, and who kind of just takes it across the jaw without complaint.
And who is spanning, we have to say, all kinds of cultures. I mean, the protagonist is a Dutch banker living in Manhattan, married to a British woman, marriage in trouble after the September 11th attacks, and he's a former Londoner, though, you know, born and raised Dutch, and then he finds sort of solace and comfort and comradeship in this huge, vibrant, multicultural community of, in particular, West Indians and South Asian immigrants playing cricket in New York. So I guess, James McBride, like President Obama, you've got a protagonist here who's working across all kinds of cultural lines in himself and outside himself.
Yeah, and still open to the idea of an unfolding identity, search that is not taking him to the rack. You know what I mean? Like, this guy is still, in many ways, discovering who he is and where he belongs through his friendship with this this West Indian, very complicated West Indian, likable cricket player.
Absolutely, and a whole lot of them, and a whole lot of cultures interwoven in New York. Joseph O'Neill, did it sort of make sense to you first that, well, of course, President Obama would read this? I mean, he's a literary president, one of the few we've had who's written quite well reviewed, self written books himself. Mm-hmm. But he's also famously a multicultural man, you know, right down to the bone, like yourself, mm-hmm. like James McBride. Did it make sense to you at that level that, well, yeah, he would find this interesting?
Yes. Of course, your hope as a novelist is that, you know, the artistic delights offered by one's work is what draws readers in. But, I mean, you know, people are drawn into books for personal reasons. And my suspicion is that, I'm just echoing slightly what James has just said, that, you know, this is a president who, for whom identity is a very molten affair, and who is, in fact, I suspect, finds oppressive the various categories into which, you know, throughout his life people have seek to put him into. Mm-hmm. And in fact, part of his great charisma and success has been to sort of abolish many of the rather restrictive categories which, you know, apply particularly in American society. And in this book we have a white protagonist entering the non-white world of New York cricket.
Hans Vandenbroek,
exactly. And the a world of non-whites, which is itself fantastically diverse. You know, you have Bangladeshis, you have Sri Lankans, you have West Indians, and
Kyrgyz, you name it. You've got it all in here one way or another.
Yeah. And then there's the business world, and he makes friends with this guy, Chuck Ramkasoon, whose mm-hmm. dream it is to build a cricket stadium in New York City. Mm-hmm. Chuck is a guy who's arrived from Trinidad, which is itself a fascinating hodgepodge of post-colonial cultures.
He's an orator and a hustler.
He understands when he comes to America that for a man like himself, who's left school at 14, but who is obviously highly ambitious and very clever, that there is the narrative of the dreamer and of the hustler is one which he can exploit to his own advantage. And
that is the culturally approved narrative in this country.
That's right.
That draws so many of the immigrants as you to depict them.
I mean, you're allowed to, you know, if you have great barriers, obviously, in the United States, which we're all familiar with, and One way of getting over those barriers, if you're in the position of an immigrant with no means and no connections, is to sort of latch on to this idea of yourself as this kind of self-made, slightly shady character, a lovable rogue, and people kind of respond to that and make room for a person of that kind.
And whatever disadvantages you're facing, you write of this sense compared to London, for example, that in America, Hood's Hill always seemed to lie ahead and to promise a glimpse of further higher peaks that you might have no climbing boots to hand was beside the point. You know, James McBride, I wondered as I read this, I mean, you wrote very famously and marvelously in The Color of Water about a black-white divide, or maybe not a divide, in your own family, in your own heritage, quite directly, your father and mother. Is this a step further into this sort of super multicultural thing, you know, every color under the sun, not to mention culture? Or is this just New York as we've always known it, with 1,000 cultures, you know, jamming in?
That's a good question, Tom. I think it's the former. I think we are moving very rapidly into a kind of a different stasis in terms of how we see each other. I think it's difficult to do, but it's important, and I think that one of the important things about Joseph's book is that it does show a New York City that has really evolved. Unfortunately, the Manhattan that exists in that book is probably not quite the Manhattan that I'm standing in. Well, actually, I'm in Brooklyn, but it's not quite the Manhattan that we see today.
What do you mean?
Manhattan has become it's quite white and quite touristy, and you know, a lot of working people of whatever color have been phased out. But that part that the book does describe very well exists. In fact, a great deal of it goes into Brooklyn and Staten Island.
Yeah.
And that's really where the true New York is. And that's really where this metamorphosis is really taking place.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the novel On President Obama's Nightstand, we're told, Netherland, with prize-winning author Joseph O'Neill, its author, who's with us, and The Color of Water author James McBride as well, looking at the book that the president says he's reading. He's maybe by now has read. He's called it excellent, wonderful, fascinating. Joseph O'Neill joins me in the studio. James McBride joins us very generously from New York, author of The Color of Water, a black man's tribute to his white mother, and most recently his novel that we spoke with him about last year, Song Yet Sung, a wonderful story of late-day slavery on the Maryland shore. Joseph O'Neill, I wish you'd read just a bit for us, maybe from early on in the book. You've got this sort of wonderful orator and Trinidadian hustler, Chuck Ramkissoon.
Yep.
He will very importantly befriend Hans Vanderbroek in Netherlands Pages, introduce him to a deep, rich side of New York that he hadn't really seen or known before. And a lot of their shared time is around cricket, which Vanderbroek had played growing up in Holland and now finds a chance to play in a very multicultural setting in New York. And here's a scene early on when most unfortunately, over some disputed umpire calls, a pistol has come on to the sort of rough and ready cricket, what do you call it?
Cricket field.
Field, okay. Yep. That they've managed to carve out, in competition with the baseball and football and other American stuff. And Chuck Ramkissoon steps up in the middle of the sort of aftermath of this pistol incident with an appeal to his highly multicultural, highly varied hues of fellow cricket players, newly arrived, most of them in this country.
Yeah, I mean, what happens is the gunman comes on and disrupts the play, and as is often the case, at charged moments, people, in my experience in the cricket fields, take it upon themselves to give a little speech, and Chuck is the sort of guy never to miss that kind of opportunity. Mm-hmm. And so he addresses the players as a way of kind of exiting this unpleasant incident.
And to say, here's what's at stake here, folks.
Yeah. And you'll have to imagine a man talking with a slightly Britannic Trinidad accent. We are playing this game in the United States, Chuck says to the players. This is a difficult environment for us. We play where we can, wherever they let us. Here at Walker Park, we're lucky. We have locker room facilities which we share with strangers and passers-by. Most other places, we must find a tree or a bush. One or two listeners exchanged looks. Just today, Chuck continued, we started late because the baseball players have the first right to play on this field, and now, when we have finished the game, we must take our drinks in brown paper bags. It doesn't matter that we have played here at Walker Park every year for over 100 years. It doesn't matter that this ground was built as a cricket ground. Is there one good cricket facility in this city? No, not one. It doesn't matter that we have more than 150 clubs playing in the New York area. It doesn't matter that cricket is the biggest, fastest-growing bat and ball game in the world. None of it matters. In this country, we're nowhere. We're a joke. Cricket? How funny. So we play as a matter of indulgence. And if we step out of line, believe me, this indulgence disappears. What this means, Chuck said, raising his voice as murmurs and cracks and chuckles began to run through his audience, what this means is we have an extra responsibility to play the game right. We have to prove ourselves. We have to let our hosts see that these strange-looking guys are up to something worthwhile. I say see. I don't know why I use that word. Every summer, the parks of the city are taken over by hundreds of cricketers, but somehow nobody notices. It's like we're invisible. Now, that's nothing new for those of us who are black or brown. As for those who are not, Chuck acknowledged my presence with a smile. You'll forgive me, I hope, if I say that I sometimes tell people, you want a taste of how it feels to be a black man in this country? Put on the white clothes of the cricketer. Put on white to feel black. People laughed, mostly out of embarrassment. One of my teammates extended his fist to me, and I gave it a soft punch. But we don't mind, right? Just as long as we can play. Just leave us alone and we'll make do, right? But I say we must take a more positive attitude. I say we must claim our rightful place in this wonderful country. Cricket has a long history in the United States, actually. Benjamin Franklin himself was a cricket man. I won't go into that now, Chuck said quickly, because a frankly competing hubbub had broken out among the players. Let us just be thankful that it all ended well and that cricket was the winner today.
Joseph O'Neill reading from his book Netherland, a newly minted winner of the Penn Faulkner Award and on the President's Nightstand. James McBride, author of Song Yet Sung and The Color of Water, joins us as well from New York. There's a wonderful moment before the game where Hans van den Broek is there, and he says, one of our team, Ramesh, drew us into a circle for prayer. We huddled with arms around one another's shoulders, nominally, three Hindus, three Christians, a Sikh, and four Muslims. Lord, said the Reverend Ramesh, we ask your blessing upon this game. And there you've got the full palette of American in New York life today. Anyway, Fran in Burlington, Vermont, you're on the air with Joseph O'Neill and James McBride.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I read Joseph O'Neill's Netherland and loved it so much. I went back and read the body of work that I could find that he'd done, which was two other novels and that incredible autobiography. And Netherland is really unlike any of his other work. The autobiography was so rich and had so many references I wasn't aware of.
That is Blood Dark Tracks, looking at his Turkish and Irish grandfathers.
I didn't know. I had to look at maps. I had to do everything. So I really enjoyed his work. And I guess I have two questions. Netherland, my reaction to Netherland doesn't go along with your current theme. I loved it because the character who seems so lost and so comatose, at the end, there is the 9/11 reference, and he thinks of his mother.
Mm-hmm.
Me being a mother, I really, really responded to that, and it seems such a healing, hopeful thing in reference to everything that we've gone through with 9/11. So I just wondered how it popped into Mr. O'Neill's mind, and my other question would be, are you writing another book, I hope?
we'll ask that, and also to James McBride on the mother front, maybe particularly when it comes to Barack Obama mm-hmm. and his own history, but Joseph O'Neill, where did this come from?
Well, I mean, you know, in retrospect, we analyze a book such as this, and we pick passages to read where it all seems kind of straightforwardly and interestingly multicultural. But, I mean, this book really arose very untheoretically from my own experience of playing cricket in New York City. And I try to be as unselfconscious as I could possibly be about the kind of the sort of obvious literary themes which sort of, you know, one can retrospectively almost attach to the book. And so I'm very grateful.
You mean the Gatsby themes, et cetera?
Well, the Gatsby themes, also the kind of multicultural theme, and the various other kind of...
That was unconscious? I mean, you've got almost lists in here of all the nationalities.
Yes, nothing is utterly unconscious. Mm. But you don't want to when you're writing a novel, you're trying to avoid buying into too many pre-existing ideas about the world. And so I'm very grateful for Fran's reaction to the human side of the book. And interesting about the mother, because as James McBride's book reveals, you know, if your personal situation is a complex one, you know, it's hard to find a person who will witness you in an appropriate way, who will witness your experience, bear witness to your particular situation, and the mother in his book is. Mm-hmm.
Ruth McBride.
Yes, Ruth McBride is this remarkable, remarkable woman who is the white Jewish mother, mm-hmm. Married to a black man, mm-hmm. and having a bunch of, in fact, married to two men, and having a bunch of children, James McBride included, and giving rise to this extremely unusual situation in terms of where they're situated in society, and. I just think that the mothers are such important witnesses to our lives, and they have the ability to kind of transcend the categories which would normally restrict the way we view people.
James McBride, can we impose on you to do a little channeling here, or try to? I mean, put your novelist artist to work through the famously biracial eyes and experience of the president, maybe some of your own's in there too, and Joseph O'Neill with his own multicultural background. But imagine Barack Obama reading this in the Lincoln bedroom in the White House, you know, after midnight, he tells us. What comes up to you when you try and look through that lens? The multicultural, the mother, Fran points out, a very important figure in this book. Do a little channeling for us if you can, James.
Well, if the president is channeling, I'm hoping he's channeling a new car for me first. But,
yeah, me too.
Yeah, that would be a nice channel. But I think that the mother character in this book is pretty strong and very independent and certainly a unique woman, a very beautiful woman. And all those attributes can probably be characteristic of the president's late mother. I'd also like to address the reader who called earlier, and also you, Tom, with regard to Joe's creation of this book and this character and the great Gatsby mm-hmm. Reference. What novelists do and what Joe has done here really cleverly is that they just create characters that start to move around. And once those characters start to move around, those characters just basically take on a life of their own, and then the novelist's job is to follow that character.
Mm-hmm.
And so what Joseph really did very well, supremely well, is that he walked us through this man's experience in New York, through this man's perspective. And so whatever happened to the guy in the guy's head is what happened. It wasn't what Joseph really wanted to happen. He just became the recorder of the event. That said, the fact that the protagonist in this book is led around by this Trinidadian into this world that we very rarely see, and is, I think, what makes this book special, and special to the president, because he is in many ways like Joe O'Neill. Joe O'Neill is kind of he's a mongrel of nationality, different nationalities.
Irish, Turkish, raised in Holland, off to the UK, off to the United States. And that's our time.
Yeah.
Yeah. How come I can't hire somebody like you to work as a cook for me?
No, you wouldn't want to do that. That would be unless you like cheese sandwiches. I sort of think that taking a point which was raised earlier on about does this novel reflect? Is it a reflection of America, or is it a reflection of some future state or some new state? And my feeling is that. we live in such a globalized world now, and New York is such a good example of that, that that we have to start thinking almost in a post-national way, so that it's not possible to simply regard this as the most recent manifestation of, you know, an indigenous cultural development within the United States. I think it's a global thing, and it's splashing all over this country like it is all over many other countries.
Let's get a call from Abe in Holyoke, Massachusetts. Abe, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well.
Thank you for taking my call. It's very gracious of you.
You're quite welcome.
And it's also an honor to speak to the author. I read his book, The Color of Water. It was an excellent book. Excellent, excellent. I really enjoyed it. Especially the part where the child became aware of his multicultural or his ethnic background, that his mother was white and all his friends were black, and he asked her what color she was. He finally asked her, and she said, I'm the color of water.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
And that just impacted me. Powerfully. I mean, it stayed in my mind. It's a very powerful line in that book. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Abe. And what about Netherland? Have you read it?
Unfortunately, I just became aware of Netherland. I haven't had a chance to read it, but based upon his previous writings, I will definitely pick it up. I'm also a very big Richard Wright fan, and the book The Color of Water reminded me of Richard Wright in the sense that it painted a picture in your mind as you read this. You could actually see the images come to life. And I'm a first-generation Cuban Hispanic, okay? Vietnam.
Well, sounds like we may have lost Abe there, but he calls to mind Richard Wright and Native Son.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think that's, you know, that's not a... that's not a... Joseph is certainly on that level and beyond. I think it would make me feel better, however, if people started to see this kind of writing, whether it was written by a person like Joseph, who is a mix of many races, or any writer of any color, just to start seeing it as writing that just speaks to people about elements, as opposed to saying this is a book by a black writer or a Muslim writer that's my
amen. Theory. Amen.
That's why this is an important book as well.
I mean, I mean, when I read The Color of Water, I'd noticed that in addition to sort of documenting rather sort of brilliantly, if I may say so, the kind of various issues, as so-called, that arise around, you know, white-black families, it sort of culminates in this kind of, I hope this isn't putting it too strongly, but this impatience with... with the various issues that in fact the author has been and his mother have been forced to contend with, and you sense a yearning at the end.
Throw it off, be done. Yeah, move on. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, let's and my question for James is that I suppose Obama figures in this question is what he feels about the prospect of post-racialism in this country.
I mean, I should say in Netherland, race per se almost never comes up explicitly in your characters' mouths.
Well, it doesn't because there are other things bonding the characters, and thankfully, in many ways, the characters are, although obviously subject to the various issues surrounding race, are kind of have found their way to sort of go beyond them.
James McBride, post-racial is too big a phrase for us to do in a second, and that's about all we've got before break. If you'll hold that thought, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about the novel on President Obama's nightstand, Netherland, which is with its author, Joseph O'Neill, and with The Color of Water's author, James McBride. Joseph O'Neill with me in the studio. James McBride with us very graciously today from New York City. It's a world where you've got kind of a displaced Dutchman married to a British woman in New York. His friend is a Trinidadian with cricket dreams in his eyes, with all kinds of businesses on the side. He says he's got working for him Bangladeshi cement guys, Irish painters, Guatemalans and Russian plasterers and Grenadian carpenters and Italian roofers, all from Brooklyn. Is this your America, our America now. And is it different from the old melting pot in New York? We're at 800-423-8255. Joanna is on the line from Newton, Massachusetts. Joanna, you're on the air with Joseph O'Neill and James McBride.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Netherland is on my book stand because it's my current book club read, so I'm really looking forward to reading it after this. Right now, I'm calling in specifically, though, about The Color of Water. And what I wanted to say was that I read Color of Water at the same time that I read Angela's Ashes, and I would recommend to people that they read both books together. I think it's really interesting how the mothers differed in how they managed the situations in which they were in with lots of children that they had to manage essentially on their own. And I thought James McBride's mother was a hugely impressive woman, and how well she just managed. And I wonder whether or not any of the folks have read that along with Angela's Ashes and noticed the difference. Thank you.
Joanna, thanks very much.
Can I make a comment?
Yes, please.
That?
James.
Well, first of all, just so you listeners know, my mother's still alive. She's not in great health, but she's still alive.
That's good to know.
The second part I'd like to mention is that this is one of the problems that writers like Joe O'Neill and writers like myself and many others face at times, and that is that we have got to start looking beyond. And this is no criticism of your reader who called up, who read my book. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Dominus Homus.
Oh, James, are you there? Oh, sounds like we lost that line for a second. We'll come back to the thought. I've got a question for you, Joseph
mm-hmm.
O'Neill. And it goes to this. You mentioned the Gatsby thing that several reviewers raised. It's out there. And I was trying to figure that out. I mean, on the one hand, you've got this kind of post 9/11 pallor over New York. This is mm-hmm. not the bright and shining city on the hill. This is not young America. You have your protagonists saying that they're trying to figure out whether they're in a pre-apocalyptic situation, maybe like European Jews in the 30s or the last citizens of Pompeii, or whether they're just in a near-apocalyptic situation. You know, that compared to what Michiko Kakutani in her review, it's a year ago now, but she says some of your passages reverberate with echoes of the Great Gatsby. Mm. It's a vision of New York. He said, the old island here that flowered once for Dutch sailors' eyes, the fresh green breast of the new world, talking about the hero's belief in the green light, the orgiastic future that year by year recedes before us, and yet it's green and orgiastic. I'm not sure how to put this, but if you're Gatsby-esque, is it still light? Is it still a bright light on the horizon? Are these immigrants, you know, asked to sort of put their faith in something more murky?
Well, I mean, I when I was growing up in Europe, I always thought the American dream was just this theme you were asked to write about when you were thinking about American books. And then I came to live in America, and I listened to politicians, you know, campaigning. I saw that actually, they kept talking about the American dream as well. So it's a very substantial part of the American story, and it's not confined to immigrants. The idea is that anyone in America is able to kind of mobilize themselves by effort and change their circumstances for the better.
But your characters are doing it in a kind of post 9/11 gloom at many points.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, 9/11 was a horrifying human event, but you know, if you step back from it, you also see that it, in addition to the sort of the kind of killing aspect of it, it also inflicted a great kind of blow to American self-confidence and to American sense of safety, so that you had a very frightened America as for a number of years.
And in America, that, all these immigrants, what are they supposed to see or hope for? It's not exactly green and shiny.
Well, I'm not sure.
As
I'm
you
not,
present, it's
yeah,
kind of tattered.
I'm not sure that 9/11 really would have had such an impact on the immigrant perspective.
Well, maybe apart from that, just the New York you give us, it's gritty. It's it's down at the heel.
Well, I mean, I think New York has often been that way, and it has always been that way, and it seems to me that. But I do actually think, and I'm partly speaking from my own experience, that it is possible, given the kind of economic organization of the United States into this giant market, and given the various kind of and given the basic receptiveness to sort of good ideas and business, that I think immigrants do have a track record very, you know, it's which is objectively verifiable, of significantly improving their circumstances pretty quickly. So I think from their point of view, it the American dream is, you know, as alive as it ever was. I actually think that the bigger problem in the United States, as far as I can see, is that the people who've already been here for a long time have very kind of surprisingly low rates of material self-improvement. So that, you know, I mean, most people wouldn't know this, but your grandfather's occupation in the United States is a much better predictor of your occupation than it would be in Europe. People here seem to think that, you know,
the old upward mobility thing, a little trouble.
Well, I mean, yes, very much so.
We'll have James McBride back in just a second. First, a call from Fort Myers, Florida, and Brian, you're on the air.
How you doing, Tom?
Pretty well. What do you hear?
Okay, I want an opinion on the globalization of the world as a whole.
Yes.
I'm a son of two Hispanic immigrants. Both my mom and dad were born in the Dominican Republic.
Yeah.
And my girlfriend is from Germany, and she came to America when she was about 11, so she was basically raised most of her childhood in Germany. And I've gotten a very unique perspective of how globalization is affecting the United States, because it personally affected me.
You're pulling it all together there in Florida. Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah, and how's it working for you, for the world?
It's working beautifully, and I think it's one of the most wonderful things that has actually happened to planet Earth, because we have such huge issues that we have to deal with as a whole, like global warming, terrorism, poverty, and we can't handle these issues single-handedly by ourselves. I mean, they're so massive and so huge that to think that us as one nation can take on these problems by ourselves is, you know, foolish. We need everybody on board. And I think that globalization will bring peace to the entire world and will bring prosperity. And we will see more and more of it as time progresses.
Hey, Brian, let's pray you're right, because it's clearly happening. And thanks very much for your call. James McBride in New York, I think we've got you back there now. We lost you in mid-thought on where you hope things are going.
Well, I hope things are my guess is that things are going in the right direction. We our young people and Americans in general have decided that we are going to make the painful journey into a new kind of multiculturalism. It's very hard to change for all of us, and it's very hard to be different. It's very hard. It's sort of like me saying to you, "Hey Tom, I got some hip hop music I want you to hear," and you know, and I stick the headphones on and then I tape them to your ears. And you know, maybe after about an hour, you say, "Okay, I understand what they're saying here."
Mm-hmm.
And so that's really what Joe is trying to do, and I think that's what he's done successfully. With regard to New York being a gloomy place, the character here enjoyed himself as he played cricket. Yes, and New York is very gloomy, it's very dirty, but there is a human element of joy that exists with all of these different kinds of people living together, and that has always been the magic of this city, and that is partly the magic of this book.
You know, James, I wanted to ask you, I mean, people could look at this and say, well, what's new? As our caller Brian says, we've got a globalized world. It's hardly surprising that you've got people of many colors and backgrounds playing cricket or anything else anywhere on the planet at this point. But in the back of my mind, I kept thinking, you know, the last really vivid presentation in New York that sticks in my mind goes all the way back maybe to Bonfire of the Vanities and Tom Wolfe. And I know it had people of many colors in it, but the image that sticks in my mind from that book is basically a bunch of white people, wealthy people, around at a dinner party, sort of looking down into little glimpses of this other world. And now in Netherland, and certainly in the color of water, we're wading into very different waters. I mean, there is some movement going on here. There's the change you're talking about is very evident in your works.
That's very deep. Yeah, you're right. Well, I mean, maybe that's because that's where Tom Wolfe was when he wrote The Bonfire of the Vanities, which we all loved and thought was, which at the time was a very adventurous book and still is it's a wonderful piece of literature. What Joseph is doing here is doing what you just said, and that really involves a lot. I mean, just because you walk into the pig pen doesn't mean you know how to feed the pigs. Now, that's a terrible analogy, but you get the notion. I mean, we're trying to learn how to be different. We're trying to learn how to accept those who are not quite like us. And it's, you know, it was difficult when you had Italians and Jews and Irish people going at it. Now you have people from Trinidad and Tobago and, you know, and the Dominican Republic, people from the Dominican Republic and Haitians, and they're not all alike. They disagree. They're different. So it's really folding in the Eurocentric part of American culture with the Afrocentric or the Asian-centric elements or the Latino-centric elements that have become a great part of American life. And this is what's making our country great, if we can open our minds and hearts to it.
Let's get a call from Canton, Connecticut, and Ruth. Hi, Ruth, you're on the air.
Hey there. I have to say, it drives me nuts when you guys do programs like this. And I think partially because I feel like the reason we're talking about these books is because when you cut under the skin and you get to the fat, it's good literature. It doesn't matter where you came from. It doesn't matter who's in it. As long as you're speaking to universal principles and it's done well and it's done in an amazing fashion, it speaks to everybody. I mean, I'm Portuguese. I'm American Indian. I'm, you know, I mean, all of these different things in my life, and I feel like we've been that way from the beginning of time. We've always come to different places and experienced different people and fallen in love with them and their cultures. It's really what's underneath in literature, the nitty-gritty, the fat, the gristle, that's telling us whether this is good literature or not. So aside from what cultures are in there, you could take those cultures and mix them up, and there could be tons of other elements that could go into a book about the color of skin and the way a person speaks.
Hey, Ruth, you know, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, it's definitely at the end of it all, it's about good literature, great literature. At the same time, it's about something. There's particularity in here that's quite wonderful, and I think you can look at both. Joseph O'Neill, what do you say to Ruth's observation? I mean, you had Chuck Ramkissoon saying to his fellow cricket players, you know what we go through in this country? I mean, he, as you portray him, is quite aware of the particularity of their challenges.
Yeah. I mean, I'm very sympathetic to these sentiments just voiced. Mm-hmm. And I think that James expressed them, and indeed I've made reference to them earlier on. Mm. On the other hand, you know, one of the ingredients of the... I mean, America has enormous problems with social justice, but it also represents but at the same time, it's also a world leader in the question of you know, different people living together, and I think one of the ingredients for that success has been a certain amount of self-consciousness about it and a certain amount of reflectiveness about it, so that when we discuss, you know, the multicultural kind of content of books, we are on the one hand doing a disservice to the kind of artistic integrity of the book in one way, but on the other hand, we're also embodying the kind of virtues that enable us to kind of to thrive and enables this sort of book to find some kind of audience. I mean, the whole point about writing a novel, you know, in which cricket is at the foreground is precisely to confront the American reader with the different, with the alien, with the other. And the fact, in a way, that you know, that American readers have been receptive to this confrontation with the other, I think is, it makes me rather hopeful that, you know, possibly we've arrived at a point when, in broader political terms, we will have a different view of the other.
James McBride, take us, if you would, to New York itself, which is a key character here, as it was in your The Color of Water. But you've worked a lot with Spike Lee. And that's somebody who thinks a lot about New York and a lot about race, cultural identity. You said at the top of the show that you think we're moving somewhere beyond strictly the melting pot, sort of eternal story of New York. So what is it? What is that next chapter that we're wading into here, James?
That's a good question. I think we have yet to write it. I'm not really sure. I do know that, what the reader was saying about, she really gets angry when she hears conversations about this, is that those of us on the East Coast have to remember that there's a great there's a big country out there.
Sure is.
And, you know, when the people of Iowa decided that Barack Obama would win the state, they probably made the most important step that we can mention here other than Joseph's book, because they decided they could see beyond the man's color and they could just see to his soul. That's what we're looking for. And as long as we just look for it with courage and integrity, we'll be fine. But we have to remember that we, even though we're trying to learn, we're a little bit ahead of the curve. There's a big country out there, and people are not quite ready for a lot of what even Joseph's book, Netherlands, talks about. We have a ways to go yet.
Joseph O'Neill, do you think this is going to go away as literary turf, the turf that you set Netherland on? You know, does it kind of just evaporate with the sunshine of a new century? Or
well, no, I don't think so. I think you're going to find more and more writers instinctively, as they must, because writers must write instinctively. Instinctively writing about what they know about, and what they know about will change in accordance with how culture is organized. And culture, the organization of culture, is changing, is becoming more internationalized. I mean, you can now, if I want to write a novel about Kazakhstan, I can probably read a blogger from Kazakhstan and get all the details from there. So it's a smaller, more complicated world, and I think writing will reflect that.
Well, and off we plunge with two wonderful writers who we're very grateful to for having joined us today. Joseph O'Neill, author of Netherland. Congratulations on the president picking it up. And thank you so much for being with us today. And James McBride, my friend, you're very good and gracious to have joined us today, author of The Color of Water and Song Yet Sung. James, it's wonderful to have you with us. Thanks so much for jumping in.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. Great to have you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.